Well, let's see. We got trade. We got a little more trade. And then we got Karamo Brown from Queer Eye. Just cuz. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Tuesday, 5 March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with some metallurgy and some national security trade policy. Specifically, Section 232 of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962 as amended. There's a lot in that sentence, so let me explain. The aforementioned Section 232 lets the president impose tariffs at his discretion on certain imports that he, or eventually she, decides are essential to national security, which is to say, American national security demands this country have its own industries in the tariffed items. Make sense? All right, that is the legal grounding for the president's tariffs last year on steel and aluminum, Section 232. Now, to the metallurgy. The Commerce Department says, under Section 232, it's looking into putting tariffs on imports of something called titanium sponge. Except this time, it's not acting at the behest of the White House. It's a company called Timet that's doing the asking, the only manufacturer of titanium sponge in the United States. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra takes it from there.
Titanium sponge is a raw form of titanium that's used in a lot of military equipment.
Helicopter blades, jet airframes and engines, tank armor.
Jennifer Hillman teaches at Georgetown Law. The companies that make those things import 60% of the titanium they need from other countries. And Timet, again, the only company in the U.S. that makes titanium sponge, is arguing,
because it's used in all of these military applications, that is, in essence, a threat to the national security of the United States.
If the Commerce Department agrees, the president could impose tariffs on titanium imports. But Bernd Jansen, a trade lawyer at Akin Gump, says there's bound to be some pushback. For one thing, the U.S. gets most of its titanium from Japan.
And Japan, of course, is one of the closest military allies of the United States.
Timet's argument is a little different from the one the Trump administration used to justify tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. In those cases, the administration said the country needs healthy steel and aluminum sectors to have a strong economy. Jansen says that's a controversial reading of the law.
What we're seeing now really is a stretching of the statutory concept of national security to include economic security.
In other words, he says the administration has been using the national security argument as an economic policy tool. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Just because you can never have enough trade. All right, that's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but the news is the news. There is a meeting in Washington tomorrow with the European Union trade delegation and American officials about cars, nominally, and the Trump administration's demand that the EU cut its tariffs on American vehicles. As happened oftentimes with trade, though, things have gotten messy, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from the European desk in London.
These talks should be easy. Unlike China, the EU is not a geostrategic rival for the US, and it hasn't been ripping off American technology. The spat over car tariffs could be settled fast, says Daniel Gross of the Center for European Policy Studies.
The EU could reduce its high tariffs on cars, the US a little bit on trucks, and then both sides could claim victory. Therefore, if it were only about cars, there wouldn't be really a problem.
The problem is it's also about farm produce like chlorine-washed chicken and hormone-treated beef. The US wants to sell the stuff in Europe, but analyst Peter Klepp says Europe won't stomach that because of protectionism and consumer irrationality.
There's this irrational fear about American food. Nobody seems to notice that Americans are eating it, so it can't be the end of the world.
Nevertheless, says Holger Schmieding of the German bank Berenberg, this produce is political poison here.
It would topple, for instance, the German government if the government were to try to lower the German or European consumer protection standards for certain agricultural goods.
The US and the EU want to avoid a trade war. Professor Alan Winters of Sussex University thinks they probably will, but
quite a significant chance, I think, that we really could have a major bust-up, and that would be really serious for the world.
At $1.25 trillion a year, this is by far the world's biggest trade relationship. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, flatty, flat, flat, flat. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The oil industry in this economy is really a tale of two industries, the smaller independent producers and the ginormous multinationals, of which, the big ginormous ones, there is news today. Chevron and ExxonMobil said this morning they're going big in the shale oil fracking business down in the Permian Basin in Texas, which we noted because for the better part of the past decade or so, that side of the American oil production boom has been the province of the independent drillers. Marketplace's Ben Bradford explains what's going on there.
When big oil companies were looking for new reserves a decade ago, analyst Artem Abramov at Rystad Energy says they turned to the sea.
Back in 2010, the world was still hoping that deep water will become the next major source of supply.
But that is expensive. And meanwhile, independent producers began extracting large amounts of oil and gas from shale rock on land. Chevron and ExxonMobil first invested in the large U.S. shale formation called the Permian Basin only a few years ago. But now, both companies say they will double production within 5 years. History professor Diana Hinton at the University of Texas Permian Basin says this is the nature of the oil game.
The small guys come in and they set the table, and then the majors buy them out and enjoy the banquet.
Carr Ingham at the Texas Alliance of Energy Producers says that'll drive up the cost of land for smaller producers that have tighter margins.
There probably is some element of squeezing out the smaller producers, or at least kind of pushing them to the fringes where that production may be cheaper per barrel.
The big oil companies haven't completely eliminated their own risk. Hinton says shale drilling is still a new field.
What we don't know is how long this level of production will hold up.
As long as it does, it's good news for consumers at the gas pump. U.S. shale production has helped cut oil prices by about half over the past 5 years. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, an oil-adjacent industry, cars, and the insuring thereof. A chat with Tom Wilson, the CEO of Allstate. Fans of the Netflix hit Queer Eye will already know this, but season 3 drops later this month, and if somehow you have managed to live through the past year or so in this economy without hearing about this show, it's a makeover, if you will, of a makeover show from the mid-2000s called Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. Five gay guys, the Fab Five they were called, offering wardrobe, grooming, and lifestyle advice to a usually stylistically challenged heterosexual man. The new show is similar, but a bit different, a tad broader in the scope of the makeover. Karamo Brown is the designated culture expert in the new Fab Five, a one-time social worker and therapist. He's the life coach, kind of that group. Anyway, he came down to Marketplace World headquarters here in Los Angeles the other day to talk about the show and his new memoir. It's called Karamo. He and I sat down in the studio, we said our hellos, and then we got right to it. So look, we're going to get to you and the book and the show and all that stuff in a minute. But I want to pull out a thread that's actually in the book about, in essence, how you wound up doing what you're doing.
Yes.
And it's a guy we've had on this program, RuPaul.
Yes.
I want you to tell me what it was about RuPaul that made you say, I want to do that.
Well, my two personal heroes are Phil Donahue and RuPaul. And when I was in the, I think it was 8th grade?
Yeah, you were a kid.
Yeah, I was a kid. He had a VH1 talk show that not many people know about because they only know about him from either being a drag performer or RuPaul's Drag Race.
Right.
Seeing a black gay man do something that was inspiring people immediately resonated with me.
I led with that because it is clear through this book and what I've read about you and seeing you on the show that you are extremely intentional. You have a plan.
Yes.
All the time.
Yes.
Like since forever.
Yes.
What would have happened, do you suppose, if things had not gone according to plan? Because you did the Real World Philadelphia, and it was a terrible experience for you. You got lucky getting on Queer Eye because you squeezed in at the last minute.
Yep.
You have a plan, but you kind of live on the edge.
Yeah. Well, I believe that's the way you're supposed to act.
Ooh, say more about that.
So something that I tell my children all the time, and I've actually shared on Queer Eye, is this
two kids, by the way, two boys.
Two sons, yeah. One biological, one adopted, is this mantra of plan, do, ask for help if needed. I think it's very important for you to have clear intention about where you want to go. But along the line, things are going to pop up that don't give you what you thought the outcome should be. And that's when you have to ask for help and readjust. Failure isn't the opposite of success. It's part of it. And if you can use failure as gifts that are given to you to get to the life you want, then you'll always be great.
Okay, so two then season one of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So you get on the show and it's all great and, you know, the five guys and you're having a good time and
yeah.
all of that. But in the course of filming season one, it's your sense, as you say in the book, that the producers are trying to put you into a slot
mm-hmm.
that you maybe are not happy with. They want you to talk about plays and art and this and that. And you're like, I'm more internal than external culture.
Yeah.
And then you watch season one when it airs. And tell me what you saw of yourself.
I was completely embarrassed because of season one.
Yeah.
I watched the first episode with my children. And they were like, here's our father who's educated, who worked as a social worker and a psychotherapist for many years. And he's making photo albums.
Right.
And I was embarrassed by that. And I understood what they were trying to do. Queer Eye, for the most part, from the original iteration to now, has been a visual show. People would like to see physical makeovers. And I think that we underestimated the audience to where now, with season three coming out, they are like, Karamo, go for it. Help people understand why they haven't had a haircut in 20 years, why they haven't changed their clothes in 20 years, why they're self-deprecating, especially in a space where most people don't understand that their behaviors are hurting them. I think it's important to have someone like myself on the show and to have a book like this to give them advice so they can live better lives.
That's so funny you call this an advice book, because it's really not. It's your life's there's no, you know, subparagraph of here's what you do in this situation. It's you, you know, iterating your story.
Well, I think a lot of us learn from other people's examples. That's why shows like Queer Eye are so important to us, because someone living their life shows you a roadmap of what you can do. And the stories that I discuss in the book are universal. How to deal with addiction, how to deal with abuse.
Yeah.
And I do share some examples of what you can do to have those hard conversations with people in your life, which is that direct advice.
Important point, not to be glossed over.
Yeah.
Here you are in your sparkly baseball jacket and you know, designer frames.
This is a bomber jacket.
It's a bomber jacket. You're right. Sorry. It's baseball hat.
Yeah. Baseball hat, yeah.
But look, you actually have been there. You've been in addiction and you've been in an abusive household, right?
Yes.
So you know whereof you speak.
Mm-hmm. I have. I've been through these things. And a lot of times people will contact me on social media and say, you don't understand because you've never lived it. And I say, no. I've went through the gambit of it. I've had addiction. I've went through a household of physical abuse, emotional abuse. I have been a single parent who was making $40,000 a year trying to support two children. Social workers don't make that much.
But you've also been the guy who, after Real World and probably now too, can get paid $10,000 for showing up at a club in Hollywood and sticking around for 30 minutes.
I did after The Real World. Yeah. Those days are gone. There's no more club appearances.
No more club appearances. Yeah. Well,
after The Real World. But at that time, I didn't have the guidance from my parents to know how to even manage that money. I'm not like one of these individuals who were raised with a silver spoon in my mouth and now I've always lived with private planes. I still have never been on a private plane. You know what I mean?
Just for the record.
Yeah. I remember the first time I was in first class the other day. You know, it's a very real experience for me.
So let me ask you a little bit of a poke in the eye question.
Yeah,
here. And this is going to it's going to sound political, and I really don't mean it to. But you're a deeply thoughtful man who makes his living now on a reality television show.
Mm-hmm.
Who got his break in reality television 15 years ago,
exactly.
And we live in a society and an economy which is deeply fractured, at least in part because of reality television.
Okay.
Discuss.
So I was on a reality show 15 years ago where I added to that fractured nature, where I was all about the arguments and no solutions. And I then took a 12-year break, let's be clear about that, where I worked on myself and went back to being in my career. And when I made the decision to come back to television, I decided I can't go back into this space where I am adding to the division that we're feeling in our country. And so it was an intentional choice to make sure that if I was going to be back in TV, that I was going to do things that were going to somehow try to heal and help us to grow. And so what Queer Eye has done for me is given me an opportunity to say to people, yeah, at one point I was a little ass, but now I've learned and now you too can figure it out and grow. Because at the end of the day, we all want love. We all want support. We all want someone to care for us and to show that back to other people.
Karamo Brown, you know him from Queer Eye? He's got a book out too.
called Karama. Thanks for coming. That's a smart title, man.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you want to see Karamo's sparkly jacket, bomber jacket, he says, baseball jacket, I say, and maybe hear where he thinks Queer Eye is going to be 5 years from now, well, you can actually watch the full conversation on our YouTube channel. We are Marketplace APM. And while you're there, subscribe, please. Coming up.
Most members of Congress are looking at how it's going to affect their constituents and how it will affect the re-election coming up in 2020.
The new NAFTA and those Congress people staying in Congress. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 13 points today. We'll call that flat, 25,806. NASDAQ flat, 75.76. The S&P 500 flat, 27.89. At the Food and Drug Administration, Commissioner Scott Gottlieb directed the agency's response to tobacco and e-cigarettes. U.S. tobacco stocks jumped immediately after the news today that Gottlieb is going to step down. Altria finished up 0.8%. Turning Point Brands gained 12.7% today. Gottlieb also sought speedier approval of medical devices. Cardinal Health down 2% today. Medtronic found 0.4%. Pizza chain Papa John's has reached a settlement with controversial founder John Schnatter. Papa John's said Papa John is going to resign from the board. The company heated up 5% on that news. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talk a lot about wages on this program because paychecks matter is why. And wage growth is finally becoming a steady thing in this economy, especially at the lower end of the pay scale. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains why that might be.
Part of Dan North's job is to go out on the road and talk to business owners. He's chief economist at Euler Hermes. They provide trade credit insurance.
Finding skilled labor up until recently has been the number one problem.
He says they've started paying more.
One gentleman raised his hand and he said, I can't find people to work. And I am now doing something I never would have imagined I'd ever do, which is I'm hiring people with criminal records.
That is a sign of a tight labor market. But data show wages have not risen equally.
That's really happening for workers in low-wage industries.
Martha Gimbel directs economic research at Indeed.com. She points out that while wage growth for middle and high-wage earners is around 3%, it's at 4.4% for low-wage earners. For bartenders, for example, it was at 6.4%.
Low-wage employers are having to compete more and more for workers because those low-wage workers are going to have higher paid options opening up to them.
One reason is that low-wage workers were hit the hardest during the recession, so they've been starting off from a pretty low point. Another factor, minimum wage increases. Elise Gould is with the Economic Policy Institute.
Wage growth for low-wage workers, those at the 10th percentile, in states with at least one minimum wage increase in the last 5 years was more than 50% faster than in states without any minimum wage increase.
One question that remains is whether people in the middle of the income spectrum will also see strong wage gains. Slow wage growth for middle-income folks has been a puzzle for years and likely will continue to be. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
There was a report out from the U.S. Trade Representative's office the other day, the Trump administration's 2019 trade policy agenda. I totally get if you maybe didn't read it. The thing ran 373 pages all in. You know who did read it, though? Or did a heavy skim anyway, she tells me? Tracy Samuelson on the trade desk is who. Top of the list for the White House, she points out, getting a deal with China and getting the new NAFTA through Congress. And on that last one, well, here's Tracy on the especially tricky politics of modern trade agreements.
With our signatures today, we will formally declare the intention of our three countries to replace NAFTA with the USMCA.
President Trump signed the USMCA back in November, flanked by leaders from Canada and Mexico.
A truly groundbreaking achievement, modern day agreement.
A presidential signing is usually the last stop of the legislative process, the act that makes a bill a law. But with trade agreements, the signing ceremony is just that, ceremony, often the start of a long, tough fight to get the deal approved by Congress.
The dynamic has typically been presidents negotiate agreements, presidents from either party, Republicans overwhelmingly support it, and enough Democrats get dragged along to make it possible.
Senator Pat Toomey, Republican from Pennsylvania, is on the Senate Finance Committee, which has jurisdiction on trade matters. He says the USMCA faces an especially tough path.
Now we're in a dynamic where it's very different. We have a president who's much less pro-trade than the Republican consensus has been historically. And Democrats do not appear as enthusiastic about working with this president as they might have been with others.
Toomey is a big advocate for free trade, but he doesn't like the new NAFTA.
I would oppose it in its current form.
He doesn't like that it has to be renewed every 16 years, doesn't like that it includes minimum wage requirements for auto workers, doesn't like the way it changes a system in the original NAFTA to handle investor disputes.
Now, theoretically, the implementing legislation could improve upon a number of these provisions, but I don't think the administration has any intention of improving. They see these items as features, not flaws.
Democrats have their own issues with the deal. Here's Speaker Pelosi back in December.
This bill does not have, it has good features to it, but they don't matter at all if you don't have enforcement. So enforcement in terms of the labor provisions, enforcement in terms of the environmental provisions.
Other Democrats are worried that patent protections for a certain class of drugs are too long and will lead to higher prices. And newly in charge of the House of Representatives, Democrats have a lot of power here.
Nancy Pelosi, famously, with the U.S.-Colombia Free Trade Agreement, sat on that agreement for 4 years while she was Speaker.
Christopher Sands runs the Center for Canadian Studies at Johns Hopkins University.
She was holding it to some extent hostage so she could get leverage to get other concessions out of the administration.
This was around the financial crisis, and Pelosi said Congress needed to prioritize the worsening U.S. economy. Now, just when the USMCA will come up for a vote isn't yet clear. But the longer Congress waits, the more the deal will become an election issue.
Most members of Congress are looking at how it's going to affect their constituents and how it will affect the re-election coming up in 2020. And I think that the gamble here is going to be, what's my vote worth? And if I approve this agreement now, will my constituents be happier?
Which is how the fate of big trade agreements can often rest on a few divisive issues, even if they're relatively small parts of the deal. Drug patents were also a big hang-up for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which never got a vote in Congress despite a big push from the Obama administration. And if Washington was hyper-partisan then...
The politics are much more uncertain now, I'd say.
Mac Dresler specializes in the politics of trade at the University of Maryland.
The problem is, I think, for Democrats, is a lot of them both are skeptically inclined and don't want to give Trump a victory. And Republicans are quite shaky in terms of Trump's approach to trade more generally.
Dresler says some Republicans might prefer sticking with the old NAFTA over the new USMCA, which leaves the White House with a very uncertain path forward. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, we don't do a whole lot of obituaries on this program, but there was a passing a couple 3 weeks ago that we wanted to note here. Lenny Giglio had been the in-house barber at the Federal Reserve Building in Washington since 1978. We happened upon a profile of him about 6 or 7 years ago, and we called him up.
Hello.
Hi, is this Lenny?
Yes, it is.
Lenny, it's Kai Rizdahl at Marketplace in Los Angeles. How are you?
What is Marketplace?
So we're a show on business and the economy. Mostly what we want to know is what it's like to cut Ben Bernanke's hair.
Just like cutting yours, I'm pretty sure.
Well, except I have more hair than the chairman does.
Well, yeah, but do you have a beard, too?
No, I don't, and that's the thing.
Okay.
Do you do his beard, too?
Yeah, I do trim his beard.
Now, how often does he come in for a haircut?
About every 3 weeks or so.
Is your shop actually in the Fed building?
Yeah.
And can anybody come in and get a haircut?
If they know me. Yeah, I won't take anybody new. No, you have to have a reference.
Lenny Giglio, he was 71. All right, we got to go. The Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 all flat, flat, flat. Today, our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Stephen Bion, Danielle Chiraguayo, Joanne Griffith, Annika Houston, Ben Heathcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.